Okay, everyone, ready for a bit of a head-scratcher today? I mean, we've all been there, right? Locked out of the car, that sinking feeling when you realize the keys are useless. But imagine this: what if those keys weren't just your ticket to getting home, but evidence in a criminal case?
Yeah, talk about high stakes. And that's where things get really interesting, legally speaking. Because that simple act of testing a car key can actually land right in the middle of a huge Fourth Amendment debate.
That's right. We're talking search and seizure, folks, the nitty-gritty of what constitutes a search under the Constitution. And for all you aspiring legal eagles out there, today's deep dive is going to take us deep into that territory.
Buckle up.
We're dissecting the Sixth Circuit's decision in United States v. DeBartolieven, a case from way back in 1986 that's still incredibly relevant today.
Absolutely. Because this whole thing started with a pretty standard arrest, right? Tennessee, 1983. Guy gets caught passing counterfeit bills. Secret Service swoops in, the whole nine yards. But during the arrest, they find car keys on him. Pretty normal, right?
Sure, but here's the twist. The agents had reason to believe this guy was connected to a certain Chrysler.
And this is a key detail, no pun intended, but the Chrysler had a stolen license plate. Think about that for a second. Law enforcement can't just run the plates and easily figure out who the car belongs to.
You got it. So they're stuck, right? What do they do? They take those keys,
Yeah.
head out to the mall parking lot where they spotted the Chrysler, and decide to see if the keys fit.
Specifically, the trunk lock.
Right. And it's worth noting, they didn't go ripping the trunk open, ransacking the car.
Nope. Just a quick test. The trunk popped open slightly when the key fit, and that's where they stopped. No full-blown search at this point.
Okay, so fast forward a bit. The next day, agents get a search warrant for the Chrysler, probably based in part on that key test. And guess what they find?
Oh, yeah, the jackpot. More counterfeit bills, a gun, and a whole bunch of fake IDs. Talk about incriminating evidence.
But DeBartolieben's lawyers weren't giving up that easily. They argued that the initial key test, even though it was super brief, was a violation of his Fourth Amendment rights.
Which takes us straight to the heart of the legal issue the Sixth Circuit had to grapple with. Did simply putting that key in the lock constitute an unreasonable search?
It's a question that really gets to the core of how we define a search under the Fourth Amendment, doesn't it? And that's where good old Katz v. United States comes into play. I mean, any law student worth their salt remembers that case.
It's a cornerstone, for sure. For our listeners who might need a quick refresher, Katz basically established that a search happens when the government intrudes on someone's reasonable expectation of privacy.
And that's a two-part test, right?
Two parts, bang on. First, did the person actually think they had privacy in that situation? Like, did they believe they were protected from that specific kind of intrusion? And second, is that belief something that society would generally agree is reasonable? Would the law actually step in and say, yeah, that's a privacy right we need to protect?
Okay, so applying that to our case, DeBartolieben probably felt like his car, especially the trunk, was his private space. But was that expectation really reasonable under the circumstances? You know, cars are a bit of a unique beast, legally speaking.
You're hitting on a critical point, and that's where the Carroll Doctrine comes in.
Ah, yes, Carroll, always a favorite in con law class.
For good reason. See, Carroll v. United States essentially said there's a lower expectation of privacy in cars compared to, say, your home. Makes sense when you think about it. Vehicles are out in the open, they move around, they're subject to all sorts of regulations. And this idea, this reduced expectation of privacy, is a key piece of the puzzle when we're looking at DeBartolieben. Think about those roadside stops cops do. Being able to look around the outside of a car, maybe peek in the windows, all without a warrant. That stems from this reduced expectation. DeBartolieben takes it a step further and looks at that very small physical act of checking a lock.
So the big question then is, even without a full-on search of the inside of the car, did messing with that lock cross the line? Did it intrude on a protected privacy interest? It feels almost like splitting hairs, doesn't it?
Well, it's a very fine line, no doubt. And that's what the Sixth Circuit had to decide. And ultimately, they landed on the side of no. They said that in this specific situation, testing the key was not a Fourth Amendment search.
Interesting. And what was their logic there? What made them come to that conclusion?
Well, a big part of it was the whole concept of minimal intrusion. They really emphasized how limited the agent's actions were. They didn't actually get into the car, didn't rummage through anything, just a quick test of the lock to see if there was even a connection between DeBartolieben and that Chrysler.
Right, and we can't forget about that stolen license plate. It's not like they were just wandering around a parking lot trying keys on random cars.
Huge point. That stolen plate meant they couldn't use the normal way of figuring out who owned the car, running the plates. So the key test became this very specific, targeted step to confirm the car's owner, not some kind of broad fishing expedition.
So essentially, the court saw it as an identification thing, not an intrusion into a space where DeBartley even had a reasonable expectation of privacy.
Exactly. They reasoned that you don't really have an expectation of privacy when it comes to who owns your car, especially if it's parked in public. Think about it. We have license plates for a reason. They're out in the open for everyone to see. And vehicle registration, that's basically public record, too. We don't really keep that information secret.
Makes sense. So using a key to confirm ownership, especially when the normal way of doing it, the license plate, is out of commission, doesn't really seem like a huge privacy violation.
Right. And to add to that, the agents weren't just working off a hunch. They had what the court calls founded suspicion, meaning they had a real solid reason to think the car belonged to DeBartleben based on all that other evidence they found on him, the fake money, the IDs. Remember, the court really stresses founded suspicion, which is less stringent than probable cause, but enough to justify this limited action. It shows that this wasn't random. They weren't just trying their luck.
So we've got this limited action. They had a real reason to suspect DeBartleben. And the whole idea that the identity of a car owner isn't really a private thing, those were the big factors that led the court to their decision.
You got it. And although the court doesn't explicitly lay it out as a step-by-step test, we can pull out a really helpful framework from DeBartleben to help figure out if this kind of minimal action actually counts as a search under the Fourth Amendment.
Okay, so break it down for us. What are the three key things to consider?
First up, the intrusion, the physical part, has to be super limited. In DeBartleben, just putting a key in the lock, nothing more. Second, you need that founded suspicion, a valid reason to think criminal activities afoot. The agents weren't just randomly testing keys, remember? And third, there can't be an easier, less intrusive way to do the same thing. That stolen license plate, that's a perfect example of why the usual methods wouldn't work.
That's super helpful, especially for our listeners who are still learning the ropes of Fourth Amendment law. So, DeBartleben, it's not just about some guy and his car keys. It really clarifies how these constitutional principles apply in these quick, on-the-spot investigations, especially when you can't identify property in the usual way.
Absolutely. It's a very specific exception, you know, balancing the needs of law enforcement with those Fourth Amendment protections. It shows that not every time an officer touches something, it automatically triggers a search. It has to be more than that. There has to be a reason, a suspicion.
And here's a real brain twister for you and for our listeners, especially those who will be dealing with this stuff in their careers. What happens when you apply DeBartleben to all the fancy technology we have in cars today? Think smart keys, key fobs sending out signals, all that digital stuff.
Oh, you're going right to the heart of it. Does that underlying logic from DeBartleben still hold up in a world where unlocking a car might mean sending electronic signals, not physically touching anything? It makes you wonder if using a smart key in your vehicle, even without physical contact, would be considered a search under CATS. I mean, where's the line when you're talking digital access?
It's a whole new frontier, isn't it? And it'll be fascinating to see how these legal principles adapt as technology keeps evolving.
It's a challenge for your generation, really, figuring out how to balance the needs of investigations with privacy rights in this increasingly digital world.
Before we wrap up, I do want to touch on one other aspect of DeBartleben, something that came up during this sentencing phase.
Right. DeBartleben's lawyers challenged the fact that the judge considered some information that wasn't officially part of the presentence report. But the Sixth Circuit ultimately sided with the judge on this. They basically said that judges have a lot of leeway to look at all sorts of reliable information when they're deciding on a sentence, as long as it stays within the legal limits and nothing shady's going on. It makes sense, right? Yeah. You want sentencing to be fair and based on a full picture.
Absolutely. So, zooming out a bit, the big takeaway from United States v. DeBartleben, especially when it comes to the Fourth Amendment, is that those little investigative actions, like testing a key to see if someone owns a car, those aren't necessarily searches as long as there's a good reason for doing it and there's no other way to get the same information.
And that hinges on this idea that, legally speaking, you don't have a super strong expectation of privacy when it comes to who owns your car, especially if it's out in public.
It's a nuanced but super important distinction. One that any law student or lawyer needs to have a handle on.
Definitely. DeBarta Lieben is a perfect example of how these big Fourth Amendment principles play out in real-world situations, especially when you're talking about cars and investigations. It shows how crucial it is to look at every detail, the specific actions, what a reasonable person would expect in that situation. It's like one of those tiny details in a case that suddenly unlocks a whole new understanding of the law, you know?
Totally. And as we wrap up our deep dive today, we want to leave you with this. As the world gets more and more digital, and our cars become these mobile data hubs, how will we continue to strike that balance between giving law enforcement the tools they need to investigate and protecting everyone's right to privacy, especially when it comes to their vehicles? It's a constantly evolving area of law, one that's going to keep lawyers and judges busy for years to come. And for all of you future legal minds out there, well, you'll have a front row seat to it all. Food for thought, right?
Definitely.
Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.